Cheesesteak, cheesesteak, it's the
cheesesteak
shuffle, huh?
Oh, geez, is this going to be Philly's new anthem?
Every day, all day, cheesesteak, cheesesteak.
Every night, all night, cheesesteak, cheesesteak.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse goes to Zumba classes and seeks out hidden lives to understand the impact of treatment, research, and health trends.
Energy right where you use it. Point of use energy generation.
You're really just a very specialized fish walking on very modified fins.
It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't?
Anesthetics are really good at what
if
they
it
do.
It gives people pleasure. If someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I don't know. It's a mess.
Right.
Oh, could this be elevated potassium? But I'm afraid to say it's
actually
wrong.
Learned to think like a soul.
I'm literally holding in my hands a human heart.
On today's show, OCD in dogs, a look at used cooking oil as an energy resource, and they are athletic, they are hot, and they are really smart. A rendezvous with science cheerleaders. But first, back to that lovely cheesesteak song. This aired during the Super Bowl, featuring the annoying car insurance gecko dancing in front of Philadelphia's two iconic cheesesteak landmarks. These days, Gino Vento, yes, the Gino, owner and namesake of one of the two shops, has been doing some shuffling of his own. He's made major changes in his life to tackle his serious weight problem. Ilana Gordon spent time with him.
Imagine spending your whole life, from childhood, fighting temptation inside what one might describe as the belly of the beast.
Oh, yeah, I'm gonna eat it right here.
David Umanzer of Maryland recently braved snow and ice to sit outside in frigid temps and taste for the very first time a world-famous Philly cheesesteak.
Can't complain. It tastes like heaven, right? Heaven and a heart attack.
On the other side of the order and pickup windows and the bright neon signage for Gino's steaks, onions and meat sizzle on flat metal grills.
We cook them for approximately about a minute because it's very thin. We flip them over, and then we put it right onto your sandwich and right out through the window, right into your mouth.
What do you got working?
Gino Vento owns the place. His dad started it in 1966, across from another iconic steak shop, Pat's. Gino Vento was born a few years later, so it was he who was named after the iconic restaurant, not the other way around. The business consumed the family.
I mean, I basically grew up eat, drink, and sleep Gino's.
It showed. Vento started working at the restaurant in his late teens, but says he's been overweight for as long as he could remember.
I used to have, like, you know, grabs of fries, grabs of cheese whiz, like, roll up a piece of steak with some cheese. Like, I was the biggest snacker, emotional eater. If a customer got on my nerves or the workers or my dad or whatever, I would constantly eat or I would have my little hiding stashes.
Vento is 5'8", but has long weighed more than 300 pounds.
I would say I was an oversized Gala apple. You know, I was just rounded everywhere. And being overweight, you tend to shy away of being who you really are because you're basically vulnerable.
You might not know that. Vento jokes a lot and is often in the public eye, brushing shoulders with celebrities like Justin Timberlake. But Vento's weight's made it hard for him to do even basic tasks.
Things that you would take for granted, just like putting on your shoes, getting dressed, walking to the car, actually breathing.
The problems all culminated about 2 years ago. That's when his dad had a massive heart attack and died unexpectedly. Joey Vento was a larger-than-life Philadelphian, as the mayor put it, and a bit controversial. Now, literally overnight, Gino Vento had an empire dumped on him.
I mean, to step into Joey Vento's shoes, I mean, anybody else's shoes I would jump into, but his, no.
Vento says his weight spiraled even more out of control as he coped with the loss and the stress of managing the business.
I had borderline type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea.
At the time, how much did you weigh?
360 pounds. Maybe it was a wake-up call when Dad did die, you know, going, you know what, I could be next.
Vento decided to try surgery. He got a lap band.
I mean, with any surgery, there's risks and, you know, like everything, but I knew this was my last resort.
A lap band is essentially when a doctor restrains your stomach with a silicone band, allowing only small amounts of food to be consumed in one sitting. If you eat too much or too fast, you wind up dumping.
And that is when you throw up.
Research questions the long-term success of patients keeping weight off after lap band surgery. It's gradual and limited. Vento says he knew this, but he sees the band as a band-aid, one that spurred much bigger lifestyle changes. He's been hitting the gym daily, swimming hundreds of laps, hopping on machines like this stationary bike.
Do turbo. This is one of my favorite machines. It just, you know, kind of warms me up in the morning before I start any PT or anything.
I have two trainers I work out. I do one with cardio, kickboxing, and then the other one is just cardio, like strength training.
Vento did have a minor setback this winter.
There were some days I had tears in my eyes, and I was in so much pain, but I'm like, you told me to do it, I'm going to do it.
He had a knee replacement, in part because of all the strain from his weight. Now he's at Moss Rehab, but still focused on the goal.
It's intensive, and you need to be ready to work.
Mary Claire Schaefer is an orthopedic coordinator there.
Gina's been phenomenal.
And then this is my break time. Okay, right now I'm on the treadmill, and my speed is at 1.7.
Since Gino's lap band surgery about 2 years ago, he's lost nearly 100 pounds.
It's on my quad and pushes forward to get more of a stretch.
So do you think you could be doing this without the lap band?
I probably could. It's not a cure-all, but it just helps you make better choices. So, you know, I lost my max capacity with the band. So right now, if I want to lose any more, it's basically diet and exercise and on my own.
Vento thinks his parents would be proud.
First of all, Dad would probably be rolling in his grave because he's probably like, you're working harder now than you did when I was there. So why is that? But basically just, you know, being proud and seeing myself happy because they know what a struggle it was, especially my mom.
That struggle isn't completely over, and Vento doesn't think it ever will be. He says maintaining his weight requires constant discipline and setting small goals. It can also be an emotional roller coaster. He also enjoys the occasional splurge.
Do we want to eat cheesesteaks every day? No. Do you want to eat cheese fries every day? Well, no. But, you know, like everything in just like moderation.
At least for now, Vento has a bit more space from those cheesy temptations. This week, he started culinary school. One of his interests is pursuing alternative healthy cooking. He's got some ideas.
Instead of having, you know, American cheese, do maybe like a low-fat cheese or do like a cheese sauce and make it with like skim milk and like kind of like do it like an alternative. So instead of maybe 1,000 calories, it might be like 750.
So could any of this make its way back to Gino's steaks?
You never know. After school, you never know. There might be a new menu.
Vento adds, no matter what, there will always be a place for Gino's and a good old-fashioned juicy Philly cheesesteak. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And we have a video of Gino Vento working and working out at whyy.org/thepulse. About 200,000 Americans have bariatric surgery each year. Candidates are very obese. They typically have a body mass index greater than 40. UPenn psychologist David Sarver works with people as they go through that process.
My role is really to help patients understand some of the behavioral and psychological issues that have contributed to the development of their obesity and then how those issues may play a role in their ultimate postoperative success.
I asked him to explain what kind of options patients have.
The gold standard and the most common procedure in the United States right now is the gastric bypass procedure, and that involves creating a small pouch at the upper part of the stomach and then rerouting a part of the small intestine up to that small pouch. So the lower part of the stomach and the upper part of the small intestine is therefore bypassed by all the food that you consume. There's also another procedure called the sleeve gastrectomy, which really involves removing about 80% of the stomach in such that the stomach then just becomes essentially a sleeve or a tube, and you lose that curved part that many people probably have seen in pictures. And then there's also the gastric banding procedures, which involves putting a silicone band around the upper part of the stomach. And that really works by restricting the amount of food that you consume because that band really clamps down and limits your ability to eat large portion sizes at any given meal. And that's really a psychologist's description of what those three different procedures are like.
What does a patient have to know going into this process?
So a lot of times patients who come and see us at Penn, because of their own research and reading or experiences with friends and family members, have a good idea which procedure that they would like to undergo. And then we will meet with them and counsel them, both as team members and more specifically the surgeons will talk with them about what's the best procedure for them. And while there are subtle variations between the procedures about what patients can and cannot eat, when they should eat, we really encourage patients up front to realize that the surgery is not a magic bullet. That a lot of people will sometimes think, well, this is the easy way out. And there is absolutely nothing easy about this at all. Patients who undergo bariatric procedures, regardless of which kind, are going to be on the most restrictive diet they've ever been on because they're only going to be consuming about 1,200 to maybe 1,500 calories a day for the rest of their lives. And if they don't do that and they don't follow those dietary recommendations and they give in to the temptations of our toxic food environment, they really put themselves at risk for regaining their weight.
People who arrive at this point have had big trouble losing weight. They have not been able to stick to diets and all those things. So what makes one think that they can do this, which seems harder than anything that came before?
Well, I think what's important to keep in mind, a couple of things. You're absolutely right that so many patients who come for bariatric surgery are what I like to call as dietary veterans, that they've done all the different programs. And what we really encourage patients to think about and where we think the surgery is most powerful is it really limits your ability to eat those larger portion sizes.
But for some people, this doesn't work. They might eat smaller portions, but they continue to eat too much.
Yeah, so there are ways to out-eat these procedures, and some of the most common ways involve consuming what we call soft, solid foods or liquid calories. So if you're going to a coffee shop and getting a large mocha, frappuccino, whatever, and consuming that, you know, several times a day, you're consuming 300 to 400 calories in that cup of coffee. The unfortunate reality, as we've come to learn in the last few years, is that almost all bariatric patients regain about 10% of their weight within the first 5 to 10 years after surgery. And the evidence now tells us that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30% regain a significant amount of weight within the first 5 years. And we really need to do a better job as the professionals who work in this field of finding out, why are patients regaining this weight? Is it metabolic? Is it hormonal? Is it behavioral? Likely it's a combination of all of those things. And how can we help them be successful in the long term?
You evaluate people on a psychological level before they go into surgery. What are you looking for? Who makes for a good candidate for this kind of surgery?
We really look for a variety of different things. And unfortunately, there's a bit of a belief out there among bariatric patients that to clear the psychological evaluation is the hardest hurdle of the preoperative process. The reality is that we rarely, if ever, turn down patients. What we will sometimes do in about 20 to 30% of cases is we'll recommend that patients continue to work with the dietitians prior to surgery, or perhaps work with a mental health professional to get some counseling. So those are some of the things that we look for. We make sure that patients have realistic expectations about what the surgery can do, the changes that they need to make. And perhaps one of the most important things is to make sure that the timing in their lives is right. It's important that you're doing this at a time where you can really dedicate time and energy to taking good care of yourself. And what we'll often do pre- and post-operatively is spend time with those patients really trying to problem solve. You know, how can you, with the unique demands and challenges of your life, make these changes and find a way to make the post-operative diet a priority? Because I think that's really what's key, is learning to make your health and your eating behaviors a priority, that as you start your day, you're realizing throughout the day, here's when I'm going to have my lunch and here's what I'm going to have, here's my snack, here's my dinner, as opposed to making those decisions on the fly. Because when we do that, it often leads us to the higher calorie foods.
So I realize I'm asking a psychologist this, but it seems like the surgery itself is only a tiny portion of all of this, and the rest is in your head.
Yeah, I think it's more than a tiny portion of it. And I know my surgeon colleagues, if I would have agreed with you, would have hammered me for that. I think it's an incredibly powerful tool. But to use that tool appropriately, you do need to make those behavioral changes. Now, some of those, I agree with you, are in our heads. But I would also offer that some of the behavioral changes are not in our heads, but it's in the way that we interact with the environment. You live in an environment where food is readily available, and that our environment has really spun out of control in that way. So that when we start, you know, I think about the library at Penn and the fact that it has, you know, at least one, if not two, coffee shops in it. But when I was an undergrad, you weren't allowed to bring any food and drinks into the library at all. And clearly, we have food available to us day in and day out. And so if we're really not mindful, we end up overeating and overconsuming without, you know, sitting behind a Wawa eating a half gallon of ice cream. And day in and day out, week in and week out, year in and year out, that adds up over time.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
David Sarver is a psychologist working with UPenn's bariatric surgery program. Coming up on The Pulse, a prayer for Pedro Avila.
Hine matov umanaim shevet achim veachiot gam yachad.
Nos ha afectado mucho, más que nada los niños y mi esposa.
It's taken a toll on us, my wife and kids above all.
Meeting the mental health needs of undocumented immigrants facing deportation. That's coming up on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Last year, the U.S. deported over 130,000 undocumented immigrants. An interfaith immigrant rights organization called New Sanctuary Movement has been pairing local congregations with families facing deportation. As part of our series on behavioral health and undocumented immigrants, reporter Yowei Shaw visited one of the program's pairs to see how it works.
It's a gray Monday morning, and outside the federal courthouse on 9th and Market, members of Mishkan Shalom Synagogue are praying for Pedro Avila as he holds a large box of case files tightly to his chest.
A verse from the Psalms. Hine matov umanaim shevet achim veachiot gam yachad. How good and how pleasant.
It's a big day for Avila, who's undocumented, because he'll finally learn whether or not he's deported to Mexico, the country he left more than 15 years ago as a teenager.
Have been shared by Pedro and his family.
Avila is a nervous wreck. That's why the synagogue members are here, to provide emotional and spiritual support as Avila faces the possibility of being separated from his wife and kids. The day before, I visited Avila and his family at their home in Northeast Philadelphia. You could almost taste the tension in the air. Here's Avila, speaking through an interpreter.
Nos ha afectado mucho. Más que nada los niños y mi esposa.
It's taken a toll on us, my wife and kids above all. I work a lot, and only when I get home do I really think about, you know, what's going on, what we're going to do. But when we're at home, we try not to think about deportation and to take it one day at a time.
It all started one night in 2011 when Avila was arrested and charged with soliciting a prostitute. Avila says he was set up by undercover police. Eventually, his record was expunged, but he had already landed in the hands of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, setting deportation proceedings into motion. And so for the past 2 years, like thousands of other undocumented immigrants in the U.S., Avila has been living in limbo, waiting to see what will happen with his case. It's been stressful for everyone in the family, living under this pressure, especially for Avila's son and daughter, who are 8 and 13. Avila's wife can explain.
Entonces, los niños todo el tiempo están como con miedo cuando yo les digo, niños, vamos a salir, vamos a ir a hacer compra.
It's hardest for the kids. They're afraid all the time. When I tell them that we're going somewhere, that we're going shopping, or that we're going to drive, then my son will get scared. Or when my daughter is leaving for school, she asks me, are you going out? Are you going to stay home? And I just prefer to tell her that I'm going to stay home because she's very afraid that if I get in the car, the police are going to stop me. She's really afraid of the police. For her, the police are just bad.
So in general, there's a lot of anxiety. It's not specific to immigration might come to our door and arrest somebody, but it's more of this overall sense of insecurity.
Kathy Tillman is a longtime family therapist and the director of La Puerta Abierta, or The Open Door, an all-volunteer project of the nonprofit Intercultural Coalition for Family Wellness. La Puerta Abierta is one of the few places in Philadelphia that provides free counseling to undocumented immigrants. Tillman says that undocumented immigrants experience extended trauma caused by fear of deportation, family separation, financial pressure, and lack of trust.
I think there's so much anxiety in the community, especially around status issues, that people tend to be very non-disclosing of their issues and their struggles for fear that somebody might share that information with the wrong people or judge them.
All this can be extremely isolating, says Melissa Fogg, the immigrant mental health specialist with Lutheran Children and Family Services.
It just leaves them feeling completely without support and really isolated and alone in a new country that they came to, usually for a better life or for the benefit of their children. So it's hard. People have a really hard time negotiating what they expected to receive here in the U.S. and what they thought they should be entitled to versus what they actually can access, which is very, very little.
In Avila's case, his family was able to get free counseling with La Puerta Abierta, but clinical mental health services are few and far between for undocumented immigrants due to insurance and language access issues. To help fill the void, Fogg says that soft approaches like art therapy, ESL classes, and community building activities can also help. This is also where a program such as New Sanctuary Movement comes in.
You know, we're not lawyers, but as people of faith, what we can do is walk with people, stand in solidarity with people.
Peter Pedamonte is the executive director of the Interfaith Immigrant Rights Organization. New Sanctuary runs a program that pairs local congregations with families facing deportation.
I remember when we first started this, I was always very hesitant to talk about that part of the program because it didn't feel substantial. But then as we went along and started doing evaluations with some of the families, the thing that kept coming up over and over again was the community of support, was that there was a community there getting their back in this incredibly, incredibly stressful and traumatic time.
Here's the idea. The partner congregation is there for the family throughout the deportation process, whatever happens. Families share meals with congregation members and attend worship services together. Congregation members check in on family members and go to court with them. Pedamonte says the program centers around building a relationship. For instance, when Pedro Avila's family was matched with Mishkan Shalom Synagogue in Philadelphia's Roxborough neighborhood 2 years ago, Mishkan member Michael Ramberg remembers testing the waters in the first meeting.
I explained a little bit about why a synagogue would want to be involved in this and would want to accompany a family, and some background about Jewish people's experience with immigration. It was a surprisingly easy kind of connection.
Since then, the synagogue has worked hard to have Avila's back so that he doesn't feel like he's facing deportation by himself. When Avila's lawyer didn't seem to be doing a great job in court, a Mishkan member, who also happens to be the executive director of Highest PA, an immigrant legal and social services nonprofit, decided to take his case on for free. And simply hanging out has also been valuable. like the time Avila came to Mishkan Shalom Synagogue with about 15 family members, including kids.
It
was really an unforgettable experience. It was very beautiful the way they welcomed us. We never thought that there were people like that who would open their doors to us to help us. Even 8 and 10-year-old kids who were there asking us questions, trying to learn new things, and showing that our situation was important to them.
Avila says that all the support from Mishkan has helped his family keep calm and deal with the harsh reality of what might happen.
Pues hemos estado más que nada unidos, disfrutando.
We've been united as a family, enjoying what we have, and we've been talking about what to do, making plans for our future, not only if I'm here, but also if we have to go. If leaving is our destiny, then so be it. And the idea is that we all stay or we all go.
The day of his final hearing, the day Avila and his family had been waiting over 2 years for, it turned out that they had to wait a little bit longer for an answer. The government only allows 4,000 people a year to get a cancellation of removal visa, and the cap for fiscal year 2013 had already been reached. About 8 Mishkan members were there to support Avila as he got news of the delay. Here's Mishkan member Claudia Garcia Leeds.
It was only us, and I think that it was really important for Pedro because he turned around a couple of times and saw us there, you know, rooting for him. And you know, being amongst friends, I'm sure it made a difference.
Since then, Avila has gotten word that he will get the visa after all. Mishkan is planning a party to celebrate with Avila and his family soon. For The Pulse, I'm Yoe Shaw.
This report is part of a multimedia mental health journalism series made possible by the Scattergood Foundation. Last week, Yoe Shaw did a story about a program for undocumented teens, and you can find both of her stories at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. It's time for our science news update, and joining us is regular Pulse contributor Carrie Grenz. Carrie is an associate editor at The Scientist magazine, and in that job, she comes across a lot of new studies every week and keeps us updated on all the intriguing things that are happening. The picks for this week are bumblebees, potatoes, and OCD in dogs. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Maiken.
Carrie, let's start with the bumblebees. Are they at risk as well, just as we've been hearing about the honeybees?
There is some evidence that bumblebee populations have been declining. And commercial honeybees are known to have this disease called deformed wing virus. Researchers in the UK now show that wild bumblebees can also catch this disease, and it shortens their lifespan by nearly a week. That's quite significant. If you think about it, a worker bumblebee only lives a few weeks, so taking out a third or a quarter of its lifespan is considerable. They also found that in the wild, honeybees are more likely to have this disease, but that the parts of the UK, this study was done in the UK, the parts of the UK where the honeybees and bumblebees have this disease overlap. So given that honeybees are more likely to have the disease, they suspect that this deformed wing virus is spilling over from commercial honeybees into bumblebees.
And how important are bumblebees to food production, to nature, to all of those things?
They're very important. There's a lot of emerging evidence about the role of wild pollinators and their importance in crops and biodiversity. So even though we are very reliant upon commercial honeybees to pollinate crops, wild bees are also very important in providing this ecosystem service.
And can anything be done about this?
Not in the wild bumblebees, unfortunately. So there are ways to clean honeybee hives and spray some pesticides to get rid of the pathogen, but in wild bumblebees, it would really not be feasible because we don't know where the nests are. We know exactly where a commercial honeybee hive is because we put it in that place and there's 50,000 bees buzzing around. Wild bumblebees live in smaller nests and we'd have to hunt all over the landscape to find them. It's just not feasible.
Let's move on to the potatoes. This is also related to disease, this new study.
Right. So the Irish potato famine is caused by this disease called blight in potatoes. And researchers have developed a genetically modified potato that is resistant to the pathogen that causes this disease. Blight is still around, even though we think of it as being connected with the Irish potato famine. It still causes considerable damage to crops, and farmers have to use a lot of pesticides to control the disease, sometimes spraying their crops 10 to 15 times a season. So the researchers took a gene from a wild relative of potatoes. It comes from South America. They took this gene and inserted it into the genome of crop potatoes. They planted these crops out in the fields, and they found that the normal crop potatoes all got infected with blight. The genetically modified ones did not get infected at all, and their potatoes were actually larger.
But people are very resistant against anything that's genetically modified. So does this potato stand a chance?
Not in Europe, most likely. And that's where the research was done in the UK. There's considerable resistance to it. People have actually developed a genetically modified resistant potato strain, but it never got a foothold in Europe. So the research is really being done here in the US to see if it could be developed.
Do you see any changes in how people are reacting to genetically modified foods?
I do think that there's continued resistance among the public to genetically modified foods. And I think that the onus is on scientists to educate about what it is that they're doing and also then demonstrate that these can be safe.
Your final pick for this week, Carrie, is about OCD in dogs.
That's right. So dogs can have obsessive compulsive disorder. I think a lot of my fellow dog owners might recognize it in their pets. And this week, researchers report on four genes in dogs that are connected to OCD in canines. They compared the genomes of dogs with OCD and dogs without, and found that the mutations in these genes were more likely among the dogs with OCD. So there's a lot more research to be done on these genes and whether correcting the effects of these mutations can actually help the disease. But it does look like the genes are involved in what is understood about OCD in humans. So people are also thinking that perhaps dogs could serve as a model for understanding this disease in humans.
And how does it express itself in dogs?
Repetitive behaviors, so incessant tail chewing or gnawing on a dog bed or a blanket, chasing one's tail. I mean, they seem like almost normal dog behaviors, but these would be kind of excessively repetitive and potentially even damaging.
But there's no treatment yet.
There is no treatment, no. And it was interesting. One of the things I learned from this study is that there are certain breeds that have a higher prevalence of OCD. And the study included Doberman Pinschers, Bull Terriers, Shetland Sheepdogs, and German Shepherds.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor at The Scientist. How do you improve care for some of the poorest and sickest patients while balancing the books? As the basic economics of healthcare shift, doctors and hospitals around the country are in a rush to answer that question. It's one of the trickiest in all of healthcare. A small team of providers in Camden, New Jersey is reinventing a clinic just for this population of vulnerable patients. Marketplace reporter Dan Gorenstein has this story.
The old waiting room at the Cooper University Hospital doctor's office was rough. Carpet patched with mismatched swatches and walls, Sophia Kolozowski says, that time forgot.
That a wall could be stained with marks of people's heads, and it appeared as if people were sitting there, shadows of them.
Hi, sweetie. How are you?
Kolozowski, who's worked here since 95, says you can't even imagine that now. Looking around, you see modern wood furniture, bright colors, tasteful photos of long-ago Camden on the walls.
We don't need to have that inner city ghetto look for our patients here. We need to make them feel comfortable, that we care about them, and this speaks volumes.
When you strip away all the bells and whistles at the Cooper Advanced Care Center, Executive Director Kathy Stillo says what you see is a massive effort to make primary and specialty care as easy to get as just showing up at the ER.
I think we're figuring out how to redo this whole thing, how to deliver care in a much smarter and more efficient way.
Transforming the whole practice has taken a financial investment and a leap of faith. This office was designed exclusively for the hospital's nearly 10,000 Medicaid patients, patients who are often unemployed, homeless, mentally ill, and sick. Armed with a mandate from Cooper and $1 million from a New Jersey philanthropic group, the Nicholson Foundation, Stillo hopes to fuse patients to their healthcare providers.
Our feeling is make sure that these aren't just doctors and patients seeing each other in short clips, but there are more comprehensive teams wrapped around those patients.
Stillo, who came from Big Pharma, was brought in to look at this as a business problem to solve. Cooper lost $3 million providing care to this population last year, and under the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid's going to grow, perhaps covering up to nearly a quarter of the population, which is just one reason why hospitals around the country are looking at their Medicaid patients, some for the first time in decades.
Welcome to the group visit. My name's Dr. Kaufman.
At Cooper, the office has started these group visits with 8 to 12 patients, all with diabetes, for example, to spend an hour with a doctor and other staff to learn ways to better manage their condition. If a patient ends up in the ER or hospital, someone from here will go bedside to schedule a follow-up primary care visit within 7 days. The other thing, and it doesn't sound sexy, but is already paying off, reconfiguring basic office functions. That task often falls to Evan Gaston.
My job is to operationalize the big ideas.
When he first arrived, Gaston found a chaotic Grand Central type scene. Phones ringing constantly. Imagine, Gaston says, patients lining up waiting to check in, others waiting to check out, workers overwhelmed.
Well, at the same time, they've got a phone balanced on their neck and saying, oh, please, can I hold one moment? And they'd put the phone down and it would ring again. We're talking 700 calls a day.
The answer seemed kind of obvious. Move calls away from the front desk. Build some kind of call center. Sounds straightforward, right? But dealing with that kind of thing, what sometimes is called organizational spaghetti, took Gaston 2 solid months. Norma Martinez, who's worked the front desk for 11 years, says whatever it took, it was worth it. Patients, she said, often got angry, like the time a woman went off after she had to be rescheduled because her doctor was called away suddenly.
I'm not getting my medicines, I'm not being treated right, you know, I'm going to F you up. The cops came up.
And that kind of thing happened?
Let's say in a month, maybe 3 times. Yeah.
And now?
Now we've only had maybe out of the whole time, 8 months, I think maybe twice.
Less frustrated patients? That's a good thing. But it's not the same as reducing ER visits and hospital admissions. Columbia Health Policy Professor Michael Sperr says what the new clinic is trying to do, getting buy-in from patients, is incredibly tough.
Now you're asking them really to change their behavior in significant ways, and they've got to trust the people who are asking them to do that, that this is going to be better for them. Talking about changing the delivery system for the high-cost, low-income population in the United States, and changing delivery systems is not easy to do.
Sperr says no one's yet figured out some model that can be franchised like McDonald's, but the demand for solutions is growing. Bloomberg Industries estimates that at least $50 billion was spent last year managing Medicaid patients. In Camden, costs have come down 10% after the first several months, partly because patients like 60-year-old Nick Panero, who had a pain come out of nowhere, could get right into the clinic.
Sometimes I didn't get an appointment here for 2 weeks. That has changed. You know, it seems like they take you right in if they have to.
Kind of the way Kathy Stillo at the office drew it up, seeing patients quickly so they don't have to go to the ER. Stillo's thrilled to help people like Nick Panero every day, but she also knows the clinic is part of something bigger, tinkering with how healthcare is delivered so people are healthier and we all end up paying less money. For The Pulse, I'm Dan Gorenstein.
Coming up on The Pulse...
Iceberg! Burn ahead!
Hold on, that's not an iceberg. That's a...
fatberg. Grease plus wet wipes and other things that get washed down that have formed massive blockages.
Keeping used cooking oil out of drains and giving it a new life. That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
The Children's Crisis Treatment Center supports WHYY. Did you know that 68% of Philadelphia residents have had an adverse childhood experience? From physical abuse to neglect to exposure to violence, these traumatic experiences during childhood can have a lifelong impact on a person's health and well-being. Philadelphia is at the forefront of healing and resilience. On March 20th at WHYY, experts will address Children in Toxic Stress, a public health response for Philadelphia. Information and to register at cctckids.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Our next story is about an oil problem, but we're not talking about a massive spill at sea and birds covered in black gunk. Nope, this oil problem is lurking in your kitchen. Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
It's a cold winter morning. Honey White bundles up her two young kids and treks out into their South Philly backyard.
Yeah, you on a floor?
I'm done.
Whoa. What is that again, Heiko?
It's oil.
They're pouring used cooking oil from a small water bottle into a big drum. White is Indonesian by birth, and like many people in her immigrant community, she uses a lot of cooking oil. A lot.
We're using it to fry tempeh, we're using it to fry tofu, chicken, and even we fry vegetable with that.
Until recently, that used cooking oil went down kitchen sinks, where it clogged pipes and risked massive blockages in sewer systems. Now, Honey White's cooking oil, along with that from other Indonesian kitchens, takes a different, innovative path. It ends up here.
Basically, what I'll do is I'll just explain to you guys how everything works here. It's not really that complicated of a situation. What we do is we take your oil. Okay, when you guys
White
oil,
and other members of Philadelphia's Indonesian community are walking in a slow circle inside a chilly building, past huge vats of oil. We're in South Philly at Eden Green Energy. The local recycler sucks the used oil out of the barrels once they're full and brings it here to be processed. White is with the Indonesian Diaspora Network of Greater Philadelphia and helped launch this pilot recycling program with the Environmental Protection Agency. It puts the used oil on a path to creating green energy.
Usually we just throw it out with the trash or we just throw it out on the pipe and then we realize it's clogging up the pipe. And between women and mothers, we start talking and like, yeah, we actually need some kind of a way that we can trash it safely.
The program grew organically, says Lena Kim, who works for the EPA. When she heard Indonesian women complaining about the cost of fixing clogged pipes, she knew she could help.
At that time, EPA was focusing more on a push to do outreach to communities that had less information on the environment. So things clicked in my mind, and I thought, wait a minute, this is a perfect opportunity to do some outreach and information, give them info on how to treat their cooking oil.
Kim says there's no other residential cooking oil recycling program like this in the city.
What the water department said, which was great, was we do this for commercial. It's required commercially where they have a certain percentage that's recycled. But residentially, EPA, hey, if the community wants to try this, we would love it and let us know how it goes.
About a dozen collection barrels like the one in White's backyard are sprinkled around the South Philly neighborhoods where Indonesians live. Most are in places of worship. Kim says anyone can bring their used oil to the barrels, as long as they come at the appropriate times.
We collect used cooking oil. We
dewater it and take the solids out. And once that's done, we put it off to the biodiesel plants.
That's Lorenz Coates. He's operations manager at Eating Green.
I was actually a hairdresser for 20 years, and when I had my daughter, I started to pay more attention to the environment and fuel and energy needs of this country.
In addition to the oil from the Indonesian community, Eating Green was already processing oil from local restaurants, hotels, universities, and casinos. Why make such a big deal about used cooking oil? It's not just your home's plumbing that's at stake.
When it gets into the municipal sewer, it can react with other materials, particularly other flushable products, to form mass accumulations.
That's Charles Haas, the head of the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel. He's about to take this nice story about immigrants and innovation down a really gross path.
There's a word that's recently used called fatberg, which is an accumulation of grease plus wet wipes and other things that get washed down that have formed massive blockages in municipal lines.
Haas says if recycling isn't available, it's acceptable to put used oil in a sealed container and toss it in the trash. He points out that there's another environmentally friendly component to this. The used oil can be turned into a valuable commodity.
The technologies for biodiesel production from these greases are fairly well established. There are technologies out there that have been able to recover as much as 80% just on a volume basis. So for 1 gallon of oil, you would produce 8/10 of a gallon of diesel.
This whole idea is really catching on in the Indonesian community, says Benny Crispianto. He's pastor at the Nation's Worship Center, another oil drop-off point.
On Sundays, sometimes we have 200 people, then I encourage all of them, hey guys, you know, don't throw your oil in the trash, don't throw your oil to the sink, and bring it to the church, and we can gather together and we can do recycling.
If this pilot works out in South Philly, there's hope other communities around the region will be inspired to start similar programs. For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
And there's another potentially harmful substance that's ending up in our water disposal systems and waterways, salt. Philadelphia officials say the amount of salt trucks have dumped on city roads this year is more than the last 2 years combined. And experts say the salt does end up in waterways from drainage from municipalities. And saltier waters are bad for river ecology, hurting plants and animals. And once the salt gets in, it's nearly impossible to get out. The Philadelphia Water Department says it's focused on minimizing the amount that gets in the first place. For example, they transport salty snow to places that are isolated from environmentally sensitive areas. Another technique being adopted by many road crews is spraying roads ahead of time with a salty brine solution. Some research suggests that might reduce the amount of salty runoff polluting waterways. When I say cheerleader, what comes to mind? Probably not brains, right? Now, when I say scientist, what comes to mind there? Probably not looks. A group of young women challenges both of those stereotypes, and Zach Seward met them recently at a basketball game when he went to Science at the Sixers.
It's before tip-off on what will become another Sixers blowout at the hands of the Cleveland Cavaliers. But the main event on the concourse right now is a group of female scientists. A group of female scientists who are decked out in full cheerleading gear. There's pom-poms, skin-tight uniforms, plenty of cleavage.
I'm Hillary Nicholson. I did my undergraduate degree in biochemistry at Colgate University, and now I'm doing my PhD at Brown University in molecular pharmacology and physiology, and I'm a science cheerleader.
Nicholson is one of 24 science cheerleaders at this Sixers game. The group consists of about 250 current or former cheerleaders nationwide who convene at sporting events or science conferences as if at the flash of the bat signal. It's all a little strange, like some elaborate piece of performance art playing on the cognitive dissonance between science and cheerleading.
So putting these two things together, I mean, I stand out on the court and they announce I'm a molecular pharmacology and physiology PhD student, and I have my hair curled and I'm wearing short suit, and it doesn't look like what they're expecting. And so that polar opposite perception really drives the point home.
That point is that getting young women to enter into science, technology, engineering, and math careers remains a nagging problem. Even though women represent half of the working population, they're only a quarter of the science and technology workforce. And studies suggest stereotypes that science is the exclusive domain of unattractive, awkward white guys are still a factor.
Go science!
Nicholson and her fellow science cheerleaders have prepared a special halftime routine. Wendy Brown is a PhD student in biomedical engineering at the University of California, Davis. She's crouched behind the hoop with the rest of the dance squad, ready to go.
You know, our ultimate goals are to inspire young people to be interested in science, specifically young girls, and to playfully challenge stereotypes.
Brown studies cartilage tissue engineering at Davis and is also a current member of the Oakland Raiderettes. That dance team is currently suing the Oakland Raiders for unfair labor practices. Factoring in appearances, those pro cheerleaders make only about $5 an hour. Cheerleading may be a passion, but it's not much of a career.
Yay, go science!
All right, ladies.
The science cheerleaders rush out onto the court, along with dancers from the Drexel and Penn teams, many of whom are engineering majors. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Sewell.
And we'll have more from the Science at the Sixers event on a future episode of The Pulse, because our partners at SciStarter were also there. They were grabbing microbe samples to launch into space, and we'll be reporting on that.
She blinded me with science!
And of course, we have pictures of the science cheerleaders at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kaya is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the assistant producer, Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Supporting WHY.